Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Such an interesting discussion today on custody rights with non-biological parents. And I couldn't have thought of a more perfect person to invite back to the show but attorney Matthew Smyrda. Thanks, Matthew.
Oh, thank you, Judy. I'm happy to be back.
Well, we have a turkey of a discussion today, and so symbolic because Thanksgiving is coming up. But this discussion is born out of a case that I had, and I actually called you about. And the case was, parents came to me, a couple came to me to get divorced. There were two minor children involved, not of the marriage, but of two former relationships that mom had with two other dads. We were filling out a form that requires the addresses of the children for the past 5 years, and on that form, you have to list if anybody else feels they have custody rights over the children. At that point, and the answer was yes, and we named the two fathers of the two young children, neither of which was the husband getting divorced in front of me.
Right.
So I asked, are there any court cases? If you feel that two other men have custody rights, are there any court cases? And the answer came back, no. The answer reversed itself at the very end of the filing when we were signing off on the final paperwork called the judgment package. And that's when the mother said there were two existing custody cases in family court and two existing child support cases. And now the discussion begins.
Yes.
Because there's all sorts of layers to this, that in this world of blended families, which is becoming more and more prevalent, I think this discussion is going to take more and more dominance over family law filing. So here we go. Matthew, we're testing your legal knowledge here. So number one, in a divorce with minor children from other relationships, can the non-biological parent in the divorce have custody rights, if desired, or be forced to assume custody?
Right. So I think we have to look, because this is such a complicated area, we have to be very, very particular about the facts of each case. So when I look at this question, the first thing that jumps out is we're talking about a divorce. Okay, so these are two people that did actually take the steps to become legally married. They signed a marriage license. They had a ceremony. They became husband and wife in the eyes of the law, presumably. And again, this doesn't have to be opposite sex. It can be same sex, doesn't matter. But they got married. They became spouses, we should say. And one of them had a child from a prior relationship.
Two children. Two different relationships.
And so they became a family in the eyes of the law, and the new spouse, the one who's not the biological parent, did become a step-parent. So then we have to look at, well, what does the family code say?
Hold on. An organic step-parent as opposed to having a legal process naming that person a step-parent?
Well, we just look at it from a legal perspective, right? And so, again, we have to be particular here. So if we look at the family code, and again, to prepare for today, I normally don't have to prepare whenever I do any sort of radio interviews or podcasts, but for this one, I had to prepare. It was a challenge. So I did some research, and I had to do some research because I've only had these type of issues come up in a small percentage of the cases that I've handled over the years, but they do come up. And I totally agree with you that I think, given the trends we have right now, how people are choosing not to marry, but they are choosing to live together and they have children, whether it's with each other or from prior marriages or relationships, I think this is going to be an evolving area of the law that's going to become more common. So I do think as time goes on, this will be more and more prevalent. And actually, when you look at a lot of the statutes that are in the family code, some of them are very recent, even as recent as taking effect at the start of this year, 2020. But to answer your question, the what is a step-parent, that's actually defined. It's defined in the family code in section 3101, to be very specific, 3101 D2. And what it says is a step-parent means a person who is a party to the marriage that is the subject of the proceeding with respect to a minor child of the other party to the marriage. So if you look at that just from a little more common sense, once you become legally married, you become a step-parent, as it's defined here. So for purposes of what comes in, these step-parent rights, the act of becoming married is really all that it takes. Now, okay, as we go on today, we're going to talk about some other areas where the court will delve into actually what you do, you know, what the relationship is between you and the child. But just at the top level where we are right now, once you're married, you're a step-parent.
Okay.
And so then we look at the rules. And so what it says in that same section, Family Code 3101A, the court may grant reasonable visitation to a step-parent if visitation by the step-parent is determined to be in the best interest of the child. So that's the best interest of the child. I know that's something you've talked about in your other podcasts, and that's a really, really broad term. And what it means is subject to so much interpretation and disagreement and even a different, I think, consensus among judges. You know, what I explain to clients is, when we're talking best interest of the child, if you're a sports fan, it's very similar to what the strike zone is in baseball. And the rule book has a definition of the strike zone, okay? But anybody who plays baseball will tell you the strike zone is not what it says in the rule book. The strike zone is whatever the umpire calling the game that day defines it to be. So one umpire could say, hey, it's as low as, you know, your shins and as high as the letters on your jersey. Another could say, no, it's from the knees to your waist. Whatever it is, you have to adapt to what the umpire says. So really, this is where it becomes so critical to have an understanding of what your specific judge may think or believe or have published or have decided in other cases as to what is best interest of the child.
You know, it's almost like what is fair.
You sure.
know, people's definition of fair.
Yeah.
Changes. It's totally. It's not the same. What's fair to me may not be fair to you.
Totally.
But you said something interesting when you were reading the family code.
Sure.
You talked about granting visitation.
Yes.
Granting visitation, what is the difference between that and actually having legal custody?
Sure, sure. So as far as I'm aware, I'm not aware of any sort of authority that would actually give the step-parent legal custody. And by that, what we mean is the ability to make decisions about the child. Things about what the child does for religious participation, where the child goes to school, the medical care that a child has, things like that. Even things like when does the child get a driver's license or a cell phone? Those are legal custody decisions. And as far as I'm aware, and what we're going to talk about today, the family code as it stands right now doesn't focus on the legal custody side for step-parents. It focuses on the physical custody, which is phrased as visitation.
Okay, so, and again, you brought up something great. So the word custody, when used by the average person getting divorced who is not in the legal field, custody in their head is the co-parenting schedule, how much time
right.
they get with the child. But
right.
you, and I really appreciate that you did this, custody is a decision-making process. Custody is the decision around where the child lives, how they're educated, the medical treatment, cultural upbringing, religious, everything that you just said.
That is legal custody, correct. Correct.
Right. And visitation rights are different than custody. Okay, just to extend this for a little bit, grandparents can get visitation rights in certain situations, right?
Absolutely.
But they won't have custody.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. For them, my understanding of it is for a grandparent to have legal custody rights to make those decisions, or even perhaps a step parent if you're going in that direction, or even another person, they would then have to become a guardian, a legal guardian
right.
of the child.
Right.
And that is something that I don't even actually handle in my practice. That's something done through the dependency court, and I don't even delve into it. But that is a whole separate proceeding where a guardian essentially steps in for a parent. For some compelling reason, whether there's, you know, drug issues, alcohol issues, instability, whatever it might be.
Age, 16 years
sure,
old, not
sure.
able to really take care of
Absolutely.
The child at that
and,
point.
And as the guardian, they're then stepping into the shoes of the biological parent,
right.
at which point they then get the decision-making power, the legal custody rights.
So, Matthew, there's a phrase I would love for you to address. What does it mean to, quote, prove a substantial relationship, end quote, with the minor children, inherited through marriage if you're the non-biological.
Right, right. So that's a good question. And really what that means is that the court wants to delve into the specifics of the relationship. How does this person have a connection to the child? And so things that the court would look at, they would actually look at the amount of personal contact between the child and the grandparent before coming into court. So what's the history? It's what we would call the status quo if you were looking at a custody issue. So what's the history like? How often are they spending time together? What kind of things are they doing? Mm-hmm. How active is this person, the grandparent, whoever it is, in the child's life? Are they coming to significant...
Well, the non-biological parent.
Or the non-biological parent. It's the same real test.
Okay.
It's how
okay.
involved is this person in this child's life? Are they making a concerted effort to do this? Because really what we're... At the end of the day, what this is all about is going back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, which is best interests of the child. Mm-hmm. And so... I think most people would agree it's not always in the best interest of the child to bring a stranger into the child's life if they don't have a history there. However, if they do have a history and they've been involved since the child was an infant or a toddler or whatever it might be, that probably is in the best interest. And so that becomes one of those case-specific kind of details to look at.
And then would the court have to evaluate the type of relationship? I just got a flash of this movie, and I cannot remember the title of the movie, but Robert De Niro was a stepdad. I forget who the lead female character was. She had children. He came in, and he was an enormously strict disciplinarian, mm-hmm. and he didn't get along well with the kids at all. But in our scenario here, if they were going to get divorced and he wanted some type of rights or bond, then the court would have to look at the bond between non-biological dad Robert De Niro and the kids. And how would they go about that?
That's a great question. And, the way I think it would be handled is basically it would start with somebody filing papers with the court called a request for order, which is basically a motion to get a court date on calendar. And when you file that, you include a sworn statement that you sign under penalty of perjury. We call them declarations. You may hear them called affidavits. We call it whatever you want. It's basically telling your story in a first-person narrative under penalty of perjury. So one person would file that and tell their story. The other side would get to file an opposition or responsive declaration, we call it. And they would tell their side of the story. And then you go into court, and maybe even the first one that filed would then respond to the responsive declaration. We call that a reply. The judge then gets this paperwork and hears the story. And most likely, as all these things generally go, if you end up in a courtroom, this person says X, this person says Y. There's no overlap between the two of them, and they're both completely lambasting each other as these awful people who have done terrible things and lied and committed fraud and adultery, pick your whatever. And so a judge is faced with two totally different stories. And a judge doesn't generally have time to truly get into it and figure all of this out. There's just too many cases.
Yeah, I think that's a misunderstanding people have, that a judge can really understand all the nuances
right.
of their two stories
no.
right now.
They can't.
Yeah.
They can't. I mean, they could if they have a multi-day trial and these people are testifying on the stand for hours on end, they can get a pretty good sense that way. But as we know, court time is limited. Court resources are limited. It takes a long time to get to trial, especially now with the backlog of cases that we have from the closures earlier this year. So what I think most likely would happen is a judge would then have to say, okay, I need more information and I need a professional here. I need to have professional help. So they can go one of two ways with it. If the couple has means, financial resources, they could order a private child custody evaluation by a private child custody evaluator. If it's a average family or average couple, whether they're lower class, middle class, even upper middle class, and they don't have those resources to spend, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on an evaluation, then the court has a process called the PPA. I believe it stands for Parenting Plan Assessment. And it's basically an in-house evaluation that's done by a child custody professional, which is generally someone who is a trained therapist or social worker with specific focus on these type of issues, child custody issues. And whether it's a private evaluation or a PPA, there's going to then be essentially an investigation or an evaluation by this person, the evaluator, who's going to interview both parents, interview the child or children, and interview what are called collaterals, people who are not there in court but have personal knowledge. Could be teachers, could
neighbors,
pediatricians, coaches, therapists that the children have worked with, psychiatrists. It really is just whoever knows more from the outside. And this evaluator, and if it's private, it's going to be much more comprehensive than what happens in court because there's just more time and more money. So they might visit each side's home. They might contact more collaterals. They might do psychological testing, things like that. But at the end of the day, whether it's the PPA or if it's private, the evaluator is going to eventually get before the court and render an opinion. Okay. And the opinion is going to be resolving to the fullest extent possible each side's claims and then coming up with a recommendation for what is in the child's best interest based upon that investigation and evaluation that they've done. And then the evaluator will be subject to cross-examination by both sides and their attorneys. And then in the end, the judge will weigh the evidence and make a decision.
You know, it's that can go either way. It can either be somebody's worst nightmare or the thing that will set somebody free.
Absolutely.
And you really have to determine which way to go with you and your attorney, I guess.
Right. Right.
That's definitely tough to get legal counsel.
Absolutely.
And not try and do this thing on your own.
And the thing I always tell my clients is, you know, you're rolling the dice when you're turning these issues over to an evaluator, because the courts do respect what these professionals say. I mean, these people are trained and they dedicate their careers and their lives to this exact thing. So if they come out against you, it's really hard to get a court to undermine an evaluator. It's not impossible, but it's hard. And I've had cases where, you know, I have done extensive cross-examination of evaluators when they've, you know, opined against my client. And I've exposed numerous weaknesses, numerous mistakes they made, numerous things they admit that they could have done and should have done. And even then, the judges tend to go with the recommendation in spite of all of that. So it really is rolling the dice and putting not only your fate and your future, but your children's fate and your children's future in the hands of still a stranger who's going to spend more time than the judge can, but still doesn't know.
This is so tough, Matthew.
I know.
Okay, now here's another one. So would there be a situation in which the non-biological parent is required to pay child support and maybe and not get visitation? Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. So here we're talking about the non-biological parent. So we want to draw the distinction again of whether we're talking about a step parent or if we're talking about a parent who didn't qualify as a step parent because they weren't married. So there is a difference there.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's a little more clear cut with step parents. What it really does is in the past, courts normally have no authority to make a child support order against a step parent in a divorce case. But there are instances where a step-parent does something that invokes this doctrine under the law called estoppel. And when this doctrine gets invoked, I'll talk about what it means in a second, the step-parent actually is estopped to deny being liable for child support, meaning they got to pay. And so what can they do? What do they do? And really what it is. So the step-parent, and this is based on case law, by the way. I'm not going to cite all the cases, but there's cases that I found even going as far back as 1961 and as recent as 2003 where this has come up, and the Court of Appeals actually has dealt with it and made decisions and made law that then has to be abided by the trial courts, okay? So really what the court looks at is in instances where the step-parent had represented to the child that he or she was actually the child's true parent. So they said something to the child that made the child believe that, hey, this isn't a step-parent. This is actually my biological parent.
Okay.
Now, how you prove that becomes another question and how that plays out in trial, because I know that's where your mind is going. Well, how do you prove that, right? that's a whole other ballgame. But if the court has evidence of that, at that point, they can invoke the obligation to pay. And then two, the child has to be ignorant of the truth that the step-parent's not actually their parent and has to have relied on those representations and treated the person as a parent, giving them love and affection.
Okay, so this is assuming that the biological parent really isn't in the picture at all.
Sure, correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay, so that facade can
correct.
And maybe it's for a good thing. I mean, maybe the non-biological parent is a really great person,
right,
and love knows no boundaries. No legal entanglements.
Right.
It's just love.
Right. Now, but there is one other area where this can happen, though. And that is that if the court can actually find that there is an agreement for compensation, an agreement for support of the child, that opens the door to the court being able to enforce it, okay? And there's actually a really interesting case. This is a 2010 case. It's called Marriage of Schopfer. And what ended up happening was the father, he filed a response pleading in with the court where he requested court-ordered guideline child support to the stepfather. And that constituted an agreement for compensation. And that actually opened the door to stepfather being involved in the calculation of child support, which it wasn't dealt with in this case. But if you took it further, once the doors open, if things change, that could get modified and reversed the other way, where the stepfather then could be ordered to pay child support if, for example, the timeshare were to change or if the financial circumstances were to change. So the point being that if there is an agreement that opens the door to a step-parent becoming involved, then they're involved, and they're involved till the end.
So what kind of agreement?
Well, you would think normally in the traditional sense, a contract, some kind of a contract, right? Could be in a settlement agreement, but where I think the mistakes happen is in
like
those...
Like a divorce settlement agreement?
A divorce settlement agreement.
Okay.
Or even even another contract that everybody signs and is enforceable under the Code of Civil Procedure 664.6. That's possible as well.
Okay.
And then it becomes a court order when somebody files it.
Okay.
But where I think people would get into trouble could be if they start agreeing to do things like pay for the costs of travel if you have out-of-state visitation, or pay for the costs of lodging or things like that, because those things can be found to be in the nature of child support and it could open the door. So I think the point here is, generally speaking, the answer is no, unless there's some specific action. And we talked about the agreement just now,
mm-hmm.
or a specific action of holding yourself out as the parent, which is essentially a form of fraud, really. It might be well-intentioned fraud. It might be because you don't want the child to feel as if they don't have a real parent or whatever it might be. But holding the child out and the child relying on that can also open the door.
Well, let's go back to my specific case, and that is the two children knew their biological fathers.
Mm-hmm.
One biological father was more involved with his daughter than the other biological father. This
sure.
is what I'm getting from
sure.
the parents who came to me. And the non-biological father seemed to be the most involved. It was a 5-year marriage.
Okay.
So we're not talking about long-term. But in 5 years, you can bond with children.
Sure.
And if you're the most responsible, you have a great structure to your life, you're doing homework with the kids every
mm-hmm.
day, taking them to school, picking them up from school, allowing the other visitation to happen when the biological parents are involved.
Right.
Then... I'm stumbling over this, but I'm thinking of both custody and child support. So maybe if custody is already established by previous family law cases and the unmarried relationships with these children, then at least visitation can be granted and child support acknowledged / ordered with the non-biological parent. Yes.
Well, the visitation, yes. I mean, that's you have pretty clear-cut step-parent visitation there. Of course,
okay.
you know, if there's disagreement about that and how it goes to the best interests of the child, that's going to be something. And I think where it would become really interesting and where it could also be problematic would be if both of the biological parents were to take a stand against that and were to be united in opposition to the step or the former step parent having any kind of visitation. Because, you know, in grandparent visitation, there's actually a lot of law that creates what are called rebuttable presumptions against grandparent visitation if both the parents are there and they unite against that. And there's also authority when it comes to step-parent visitation that the there's not supposed to be any interference with the biological parent's rights to custody and visitation. So I think if you kind of put the rationale of them standing united together with those restrictions, if they were both the biological parents were to come in opposition to this step-parent having any time, and they were to make that showing that it would interfere with their rights, and it's not in the best interest of the child, I think that would, whether legally speaking from the family code or just practically speaking as to how the judge would look at it, I think there would be an uphill battle, essentially a rebuttable presumption that the step parent would have to overcome in court to convince a judge that, hey, despite what both of these parents are saying that they're united in opposition, I should still have a right to visitation. That, I think, would be a pretty difficult case to handle.
I know this is just speculation, but at this point in your scenario, I wonder why the non-biological parent would want to go forward and do anything except what I was told.
Mm.
Okay, so except, and we keep going back to this example because I find it so fascinating.
Sure.
After 9 years
sure.
of being in family law, this case really fascinates me. The non-biological parent feels that they are a much better parent
mm-hmm.
because they
yeah.
can provide better,
sure.
better schooling, better medicine, better structure, better.
Sure.
And it, I mean, I don't know these people. I don't know where they live. I don't see them at home. But just
right.
the way they presented themselves to me, he did really seem like a very established person.
Right. Right. Well, I always look at it like this, you know, if you track this out, and I don't know anything about these people, but I do know that at some point there was a romantic relationship between the biological parents that ended. A new romantic relationship formed with the person that became the step parent. Now that's ended. They're winding that up and dissolving that through the court system. So there is a history there. There's an emotion there. And human beings can't necessarily remove their emotion from their decision making. And it may just be a situation where the original parent who broke up with the other parent who then went on to the step parent, had a relationship with them, they may still be upset that their ex moved on. And now their ex became the ex of the one they moved on with, and they're still not over the first breakup in the first place. And now we have a mutual enemy, and that is the one that came into the picture. So they may just ally themselves in that fashion and just make it difficult just out of spite, because people do that, you know. People can't get past their emotion and their anger.
How
and they
well I know.
You know, and you know, you try and just give them the right advice and have them not do that, but there are a lot of attorneys that would just capitalize on that and to make money and create a fight. And then you have a nasty court battle, you know?
Yes, how well I know. Okay, so Matthew, you alluded to something, and I don't know if you gave clear steps to it, but
sure.
how does somebody become a legal step-parent? Or what do you do, or do you just become a step-parent by virtue of your association?
Well, you just become one by the act of marriage. So once you become married, you're a step-parent.
Okay.
But that doesn't automatically entitle you to the visitation rights as a step-parent. So meaning it's not like automatically once you break up, you have the child every Tuesday, Thursday, and every other weekend. It doesn't work that way. You know, you as the step parent would have to take the initiative and file an action with the court, the family law court. You have to file a case.
Is that where you were saying the request for order? Is that
yes, that's where you'd file the request for order.
Okay.
And actually, if you want to be technical about it, you would start it by filing a petition, most likely, for a parentage action, or it could be dealt with in the divorce, I suppose, if you properly identified the children in the pleadings.
Right. But
most likely, I think technically you'd have to file a separate parentage action.
Okay.
Then you'd file a notice of related case with the divorce. So the court is on notice that these are the same parties. There's overlapping claims. The court would do with it what it would like to do, probably would consolidate them. Maybe not, up to the judge. And then in either the consolidated case or in the parentage case, then you would file the request for order to get a court date to seek these orders. That's how it would play out. And the burden of proof would be on the step parent who's asking for the visitation to establish that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So if we go back to my case, going over the initial steps on the petition, the first document filed, the most important document filed, where it has, are there minor children of this case? And this is you telling me, so I'd like to share this with
sure.
the audience.
Sure.
Yes, you can list the children, but you must put down not of this marriage.
Correct.
And then when you go to write the settlement agreement, which is soup to nuts, there's a custody section and there's
right.
a child support section. I'm thinking the custody section, would that go away?
Well, you're, the challenge that I think you're going to have, which I think we even talked about, is that as the paperwork's getting processed, if the clerk who's actually processing the paperwork sees the checked box for child custody and on the petition and then doesn't see something on child custody in the judgment, it's probably going to get flagged. It might get rejected. It might get called in for a hearing because that's somewhat unusual in the ordinary course of business.
Okay, you're right.
That's so, that I think was the concern that I had about it.
Okay,
you know?
So maybe the proper way to have done this, again, had I known there were all
mm-hmm.
these cases
mm-hmm.
too, that would have been helpful to me. But going back over this, maybe could I have put the two children down, not of this marriage,
mm-hmm.
not checked any boxes for child custody on page
mm-hmm.
2 of the petition.
Yep.
I don't think it talks about child support. Or is there a second?
Well,
it
does. No,
it.
No, it does.
It does.
But you don't have the option of checking it because they
okay.
don't want to give people the option of it.
Okay.
So you wouldn't be able to do that. But what you could do is you could do it the way you're talking about. And then at the very end, there's this section of the petition form that's called other relief.
Yes.
And you could check that box and you could say something like see attachment. And then you could actually put an attachment that you create yourself to the petition that kind of explains exactly what it
What's
is
going on.
That's going on and what your client is asking for or what, you know, what orders you would want in that fashion. I think that's probably
that's
the best way to do it because then you might
brilliant.
Avoid the flags of the system. And at the
You're
same
right.
time, you'd be putting the court on notice as to what's going on and the specifics of the case.
Okay, I think that's wonderful. Dang, this has been a journey with this case. But I've learned a lot, and look at you. You've researched
well,
so much.
You know, again, I mean, I've handled hundreds and hundreds of cases in my career. And like I said, this has only come up in a handful of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very rare issue. And so I'm sure it's more prevalent in the court system. But as far as attorneys go, this is the kind of thing that we have to go back and we have to research and we have to look at. And, you know, I'm certainly not holding myself out as an expert in this area, but I certainly am qualified and more than happy to take on cases in this area. And I find them to actually be really nice, especially when you have someone who is not the biological parent of a child, but genuinely wants to be a part of that child's life because it's what's best for the child. That's a good place
yeah.
for someone to come from.
I
and if they're
that.
Willing to go through the aggravation and the stress of the family law litigation process to pay the money that it costs to go
mm-hmm.
through it to
mm-hmm.
make that happen, that's pretty commendable.
I think so too. I enjoy seeing that as well. I mean,
yeah.
that's a beautiful thing. Okay, so Matthew, I've heard this phrase, presumed parent status. What does that mean?
Presumed parent status. You know, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but what I think it means is that when you're married and you have a child, any child born during that marriage, you are presumed to be the biological parent of that child, of
okay.
your spouse's child.
Right.
So you know, again, I mean, the best to illustrate this in an example, if you're married and your wife were to have an affair and she were to conceive a child with the person she was having the affair with, despite that fact, you are presumed to be the father of that child because the child's born during marriage. And you have a 2-year window to bring that to the court's attention if you want to avoid that.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Okay. Very important. Very important.
Yeah, these windows, these deadlines, people don't understand that you have to jump on things rather quickly because then you'll have an expiration date on what you actually can do.
Correct.
Okay. Now, here's another situation because this kind of relates to what I'm dealing with. What if the non-biological parent believes that the minor children of the other parent with other people are in jeopardy, either physical jeopardy or just not living a safe, healthy way.
Right.
If the mom has a relationship with another person as the divorce is going on with this non-biological person,
right?
Do they have any recourse to do anything?
Well, let me ask you a key question. I think that we're assuming that under those circumstances, there has not been a court order yet establishing any kind of visitation.
With non-biological dad,
right.
You are right.
Okay. So we're in the vacuum, we'll call it. There's the vacuum.
We are.
Okay. So I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer as to how to proceed on this. The best I could do is probably lay out the options if I were to get a phone call from this person and they were to ask me this. And what I would tell them is basically the following. You could first try and just go through law enforcement and you could call in for a welfare check by the police to go and have the police check it out, because anyone can do that, whether it be a non-biological parent, a neighbor, a teacher, whatever it is. You could call in and let the authorities handle that, which, I mean, in theory is the proper way that a concern like that should be handled and investigated. Now, that doesn't always lead to anything. The police may show up and nobody's there and everything's fine, or even the people are there and everything's fine. That may not resolve the problem, but that's a step that can be taken just, you know, to check on the most imminent safety issue. If that doesn't work, all you could really do under the circumstances would be initiate a court action to file something with the court. So start the process we've been talking about. Open up a case, a parentage case, identify the parents involved, and then seek court orders. Now, the problem you're going to run into is that if you were to do that and you were to file a request for order, you're probably not going to get a hearing date for 4 or 5 months. That's the way the timing is going these days. When you file an RFO, it's about 4 or 5 months. I mean, we're here in November around Thanksgiving. I have a case where something was filed last week and it wasn't set till mid-March in downtown Los Angeles. Okay. I had another case where I filed something and it wasn't anything to do with children. It was a post-judgment property issue. I filed it back in the summer. That was set for March. So depending on which department you're in, which courthouse you're in, each one has its own timeline. So if you're talking about serious, imminent, exigent circumstances that are threatening a child now, you can't wait 4 or 5 months. So if that happens, then you'd have to seek what's called ex parte relief from the court.
Which means immediate, right?
Immediate, right now. And that's challenging for a number of reasons. Number one, even traditional normal biological parents have a difficult time getting ex parte orders on custody, because there's actually a section of the family code that exists that says the court shouldn't make custody orders on an ex parte basis unless there is imminent danger to the child, imminent physical harm to the child, or a risk that the child's going to be taken out of the state or the country. Those are the two limited circumstances that you can, I believe it's family code 3064. If it's not, I apologize, but that's my recollection, because it comes up a lot because people do threaten these things. So it's not easy to get ex parte custody orders. Now, throw on top of that, in addition to that normal bar, the unique facts of the case where it's not a biological parent asking for the protection. That's going to make any court kind of put up their defenses and say, whoa, we got an unusual situation here. So I think it'd be hard to get those type of orders.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, you could try and get some kind of a restraining order in place if you had proof that there was domestic violence involved here.
Mm-hmm.
And you could seek orders with the children as what are called protected persons. But again, it's a similar issue where you have a unique circumstance that you're not the biological parent. You don't have a court order establishing you as having any kind of custodial rights. It's going to be difficult to get those things. So
you're just an organic step-parent by virtue of marriage, and that you've lived with the children for 5 years.
And that may be something that, if done in the ordinary course of business on noticed motions, would be easier to accomplish than on an emergency ex parte basis or in a restraining order.
Okay. Well, lastly on my list, and then I'm going to let circle back to see if there's anything else you would like to share that I haven't asked. Lastly on my list is, and again, as a result of this case that I've been dealing with, it is never a good idea to not tell the truth.
That is so true.
It is never a good idea with any professionals that you have involved, whether it's me, a little old legal document assistant and mediator,
of course,
you an attorney, or certainly the judge if you end up in court.
Absolutely.
Lying doesn't work. You must come clean with your situation so that everybody can guide you in the best way possible.
Correct.
And the result may work out in everybody's best interest.
Correct.
But it's that fear, Matthew.
Correct.
I mean, who doesn't deal with lying in family law?
All the time.
Because it's a protective device, right?
Of course. Of course. And, you know, the thing about lying is, first of all, you should never, never lie to your own attorney. Okay? When you're working with an attorney, you have the attorney-client privilege, and that's really important. What that means is your discussions with your attorney, what you tell your attorney, are absolutely confidential. They cannot be disclosed unless that privilege is actively waived. So if you tell your attorney, you know, hey, I did this, hey, I did that, your attorney can't be called in to testify in court against you. The attorney-client privilege bars it. So it's critically important you tell your attorney everything. And that doesn't mean necessarily that everything is then going to get told to the court. It may or may not, depending on what the circumstances are, the situations, the call of the question, the level of information requested. But you need to make your attorney aware of it. Because the worst thing that can happen, and this happens because people aren't always truthful, is the attorney finds out something when you're sitting in court or you're sitting in a deposition.
Oh, my.
Okay?
Yeah.
The best example I could tell you, I had a case where I was sitting in a deposition. I had very good counsel on the other side. I was late coming into the case. And my client had never told to me that he, in fact, was a sex offender for committing sexual abuse to a minor child decades ago. Now, not only had he done that, but allegedly, I have to say allegedly because these things have not been found, and I learned this through the deposition, allegedly, he also was not truthful with his registration as a sex offender.
Oh.
Allegedly, he gave false information to the police, which is, again, offered under penalty of perjury. Now, my clever, competent opposing counsel discovered this, found it, presented it, and it created major, major credibility issues. Now, thankfully, in this case, there were no minor children. We're not dealing with child custody issues. This was all financial issues. But those types of lies, especially those lies allegedly offered under penalty of perjury, kill credibility with the court. And you lose your credibility with the court, it will never come back. It will never come back. And it will affect every aspect of your case. Even if it's credibility on one specific issue, it will taint the entirety of the case. So it is critically important that you do not lie.
And let's take that a step farther. What if people are completely self-represented? They don't even go to somebody like me,
sure,
you know, a paralegal on steroids, as I call myself. On the court forms, it talks about you're signing this under penalty of perjury. It actually says that on the court forms.
Correct.
So just by signing your name, you
absolutely
are putting yourself out there as being
absolutely
a quote-unquote truthful person.
And there are other things you sign under penalty of perjury as well. You know, one thing when we're dealing with financial issues, which are a gold mine, when somebody is holding themselves out as not having money and you want to show otherwise, you look at loan applications. Look at where people are trying to get money loaned to them, because people will become very rich when they need money. They'll sign loan applications. They'll say, I have so much money. I have so much income.
Yeah.
And those are signed under penalty of perjury as well.
That's right.
Those are a gold mine.
Those are tough. This is totally an aside, and I don't know if you've heard of this case, and I can't remember where I heard of it, but back to lying, mm-hmm. even if you didn't understand you were lying, and this is how important it is to get legal advice, mm-hmm. do you know of a case that where people represented themselves and they filled out their disclosure forms, and now they land in court, I guess, in trial. Mm-hmm. And the wife, after the date of separation, won the lottery.
I know the case very well.
Okay, so this is right.
Yes.
Okay, and so substantial amount of money. And the husband, I guess, brings it up when he's talking that she did not disclose the lottery.
Actually, it's a little bit different than the way you're understanding. Let me give you the background on this case. This case is actually quite famous. And a very good colleague of mine, her name is Claudia Ribbett, who is one of the best family law appellate attorneys in all of Century City, actually did this case and took it to the California Court of Appeals. And so I know a lot about it. It's a famous case, and it's a great example to use for your clients to tell them the importance of disclosure, okay, in any divorce case. And here's kind of how it goes. And again, this is my recollection of the facts. I don't have it in front of me, but it's a very interesting case.
I'm so excited to know the case this well.
What ended up actually happening, my recollection is, the wife actually was in a group through her employment that would play the lottery. And this was really before the internet, before social media. And at the time, the lottery was only paid in installments. It was before the lottery even had the cash value option that it has now. So as a result of winning this jackpot, she and her colleagues each got shares of an annuity that paid them out money over, I think, a 26-year period, however the annuity were, 30 years, 26. She never told her husband she won the lottery. Never told him. And somehow he never found out from any of these colleagues. Okay. So she filed for divorce, and what she did was she did not include the lottery in her disclosure forms, nor was it included in the judgment. On paper, the divorce looked like your average couple getting divorced with minimal to no assets. Husband had no reason to know. The way the husband found out was after the divorce was over, he got an unsolicited call from a finance company, one of those companies that buys out annuities, that will buy out your annuity for a cash sum now. And they said, hey, we want to make you and your wife an offer. They were part of the, you know, Magnificent Seven or whatever the name of the group was that won. And we want to buy out your share of the annuity. Husband said, what are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking about. This is, yeah, your wife was, you know, Jane Doe or whatever her name was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she won the lottery on this date. Okay, we're not interested in selling, the husband says. He hangs up. He goes back to court for a post-judgment action for what's called an unadjudicated asset. And this is before, I believe, the family code actually had a section in it, which is family code 2556, which deals with unadjudicated assets. But the husband comes back in and asks the court for relief because he never knew about this lottery. He never had the right to look into it or see if he may have a community property interest in it. And again, I mean, you know, had this been disclosed and brought up, the wife may even had an argument that, hey, we separated and I bought this with post-separation income, separate property. It should be my separate property. But she never raised the issue. And without doing that, she breached her fiduciary duties and she was found to have committed fraud by the court. So the remedy for that was actually to award 100% of the lottery winnings to the husband.
That's what I heard.
That was what the case was
oh
about.
Oh my God.
Critically important you disclose.
And in shorter form, and now I'm going to do the long form mm-hmm. in the future, in short form, that's how I talk to my clients. But Judy, it's separate property. It doesn't
disclose
matter.
It.
It all goes on there. And if it's separate, you get to keep it. No
you
worries.
You disclose it. If it's separate property, you put it on the form, you check the little box that says separate property, and then you prove it. And you have the burden of proof. If you acquired it during marriage, you have the burden of proof to show it's separate property. But if you inherited it, if you got it post-separation, if you brought it into the marriage, just got to show that. It's your separate property.
These discussions are always so fascinating to me. Do you have anything else in conclusion that you would like to tell our listeners today?
Well, you know, I think just the overwhelming thing that I thought about as I was going through this topic and kind of preparing for our discussion today is it just is another reminder of how important it is to settle your case. And rather than submitting it and handing it over to the court, because there's so many unknowns, there's so many hurdles in any case, whether it's talking about step-parent visitation, non-biological parents, or even just traditional parents. When you settle your case, you maintain so much more control over your future and the future of your children and the future of your finances, even if you don't have children. And you also have creative freedom. You can come up with a solution that's out of the box that might work for the both of you that the court may not even be able to order. So I just, you know, and again, it's me undercutting my own interest because I make the most money off the cases that go all the way through long extended trials. But that doesn't mean that's the way they should go. And cases that settle, people often are able to move on quicker. They lose less money to the lawyers,
right?
Because we're expensive. And if they have children, they can repair their relationship and co-parent better going forward. Because at the end of the day, when the case is over, the lawyers are gone. Lawyers are an afterthought, but you still have to deal with the other person.
Yeah.
And that's even after the kids turn 18, because you're still their parent. They have college. They have significant life events. They have weddings. You have family events. You're tied together.
Right.
So to the extent you can settle, settle.
Excellent. I love that. Matthew, thank you so much. I really appreciate that you came back and hope to see you in the future. You are a wealth of wonderful information.
Thank you, Judy. And I appreciate it.
No, you did so much great research on top of what you already knew. This was a wonderful time spent. And thank all of you for listening yet again to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your amicable divorce expert. Thank you once again. I look forward to next week. Tell your friends and family. Listen to this podcast. It is so beneficial to everybody. Take care.